Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening and welcome to the Tattered Cover. I want to thank you all for coming tonight and also thank you for your support at Tattered Cover and other independent bookstores around the country. Well, we're thrilled tonight to have author Chris Cleave here with his much acclaimed new book, Gold. A riveting story about competitive cycling, the Olympics, friendship, and parenthood. Once you start this book, you're going to have a lot of trouble putting it down. The characters are going to become part of your life, and it just doesn't let you go. Chris Cleave's debut novel, Incendiary, won the 2006 Somerset Maugham Award, and his second much-loved novel, Little Bee, has been a favorite of book clubs worldwide and an international bestseller. Joining us from London, please help me welcome Chris Cleave.
Well, thank you, Marty. Thank you so much for that lovely introduction. Thank you all very much for being here. It's so nice to see so many of you here on a school night to talk about books. Thank you very much for coming. I'm delighted to be back. It's lovely to be back here at Tattered Cover. I've been here before on tour. It's an absolutely unmissable stop on any self-respecting book tour. Tattered Cover is an absolutely terrific store. It's a great privilege to travel across America, really hopping from oasis to oasis of reading that's represented by strong independent bookstores. As well as selling books, they are an amazing resource for the community and put on events, which as authors we're really grateful for. They do a thing that an algorithm can't do, which is recommend a great book to you. And good booksellers like this always make me leave with several books, as well as speaking about them. So I'm really grateful. Thank you very much to Tattered Cover for hosting us. It's wonderful to be here. And so, hey, I'd love to talk with you about my new novel, which is called Gold. I'm going to talk a little bit about that, tell you a few of the stories behind it, because I figure that, you know, hopefully you're going to read it and you can read the book anytime. But while I'm here, I might as well tell you why I wrote it and why I wrote that book rather than any other. And then I'm going to leave lots of time for your questions. And I would love to answer any questions you have about this novel, Gold, or about my previous novels, or about anything, in fact. At one of my events on this tour in New York, the first question that was asked was, had I enjoyed Her Majesty the Queen's recent Jubilee celebrations? And how well did I know Her Majesty? Nothing's off limits. You can ask anything. Gold is the story of a rivalry. I became obsessed with the concept of rivalry. It's a weird form of human relationship, like a really sustained rivalry between two people who really mean it. It's an odd relationship. It has something of hatred in it, in that it's really hard to consistently want to beat someone and to maintain that emotional intensity, to want to do that to another person again and again, unless you have a slight kind of grudge against them. It also has something in common with love, with romantic love, in that it makes both parties really concentrate on what the strengths and the weaknesses of the other party are. And it has this thing in common with romantic love, which is that it makes both parties to that relationship greater than they could be on their own. I became obsessed with rivalry. And so I've created a story about two really bitter, really intense rivals who started out as friends. Their names are Kate and Zoe, and they're at the centre of this novel. They're very top-level sports people, and they have very different ways of achieving success in their sport. And I think the best thing I can do is to introduce you to them. I'm going to start off by introducing you to Zoe, who's one of the favourite characters I've ever written. She's really, really dark, incredibly intense, and I think the best way to introduce you to her is via her coach, who's a guy called Tom. He's in his late 60s, and you're going to meet him now. Tom Voss still remembered how it had felt for him, back in Mexico in 1968, to miss out on Olympic bronze by 0.1 seconds. He could feel the anguish of it even now, in his chest, raw and unavenged. 44 years later, he still noticed the sharp passage of every tenth part of every second. The inflections of time were the teeth of a saw, bisecting him. This was not how other people experienced time. They noticed its teeth indistinctly, in a blur of motion, and they were amazed to wake up one day and find themselves cut in half by it, like the assistants of a negligent magician. But Tom knew how the cut was made. He took a call from Zoe's agent while he was soaking in the bath, persuading his knees to unlock. "Your athlete's been sleeping around again," the agent said. "It's all over Facebook." "Facebook?" said Tom. "Oh, it's a social networking site, Thomas. People use it to exchange information with friends." "A friend is someone who..." "Yeah, yeah," said Tom. "I know what Facebook is. Zoe's got a lot of likes on it, right?" "Yeah, 90,000, Tom." He held the phone between his ear and his shoulder while he massaged his knees. His inflamed ligaments weren't responding to the application of ibuprofen rub. In truth, he knew that they would only respond to his applying several decades of top-level coaching insight to his own life. It was maybe time to admit that a 66-year-old man shouldn't be doing such heavy weights in the gym. But hey, there were accountants who messed up their own taxes. There were doctors who smoked Marlboro Reds. Why should he be the first old man to listen to himself? He was a sports coach, he wasn't a pioneer. "So anyway," the agent was saying, "she sleeps with this guy, and apparently he wakes up and realises who she is, and then he goes and plasters it all over the internet where, right at this moment, the salacious details are being read by every single person on Earth, with the exception of the Chinese, because Facebook is blocked there, and you, Thomas, because you are a reactionary old man with no interest in fun stuff. Do you want me to read you the filth he's posted?" No, said Tom, not really. "I'm going to read it to you," she said, as if he'd never spoken. And Tom heard her out, but he didn't know what he was supposed to do with the information. "I'm Zoe's coach on the track," he said finally. "Who she takes to bed is her own business, right?" Yeah, said the agent, "but this is just to keep you in the loop and to suggest that..." Tom growled. What did a loop have to do with it? Why couldn't people just say, "I wanted to give you the information"? "Is everything all right?" said the agent. "You made a sort of noise." "Yeah, actually I growled at you. It's an Australian thing." "Oh, and I guess it worked because you stopped talking." "Look," said the agent, "I'm just trying to help, okay?" "No," said Tom, "what you're trying to do is to protect your 15%. "Yeah," said the agent, "but she's the face of Perrier, Tom. It's worth protecting." "Look," said Tom, "if fizzy water wants a face, that's fizzy water's problem. My job is to help Zoe win gold in the sprint in the Olympics in August." "Yeah," said the agent, "but what I'm saying is that we're on the same side here. I mean, surely it can't help her focus to be all over Facebook like this." "I won't disagree," said Tom. "But what do you want me to do, shut down Facebook? I mean, I'll check with my broker, but I'm pretty sure I don't own it." "Could you just have a talk with Zoe. She respects you. Tom smiled. Don't kid yourself. I've been trying to calm Zoe down since she was 19. If I had my way, I'd keep her asleep whenever she wasn't training or racing. I'd pop one of those little tranquilizer darts into her with a blowpipe, like they do with tigers in the wild. But what can I do? I'm just a coach. All they give us is a whistle and a stopwatch. The agent said, well, I hope you can do something, because this will be all over the papers tomorrow, and these things have a habit of spiralling. You should at least encourage her not to give them any more ammunition. Tom sighed. Okay, I'll pull her in, and I'll see what I can do. That's all I can promise. Thanks, Tom. I owe you one. Yeah, well, maybe you can make me the face of something. The agent laughed. Through the phone, it sounded like a goose honking with its head jammed in a half-empty soup can. And what would you be the face of? I don't know, said Tom. Tylenol? I use a lot of that. Yeah, said the agent. I think they'd be looking to cast someone young and pain-free. That's ironic, said Tom, and he clicked off the call. He thought it over for a minute, and then he texted Zoe to be at his flat in an hour. If he was going to assert some authority over her, it had better be on his patch. Well, that was rule number one of tiger training. Make sure the beast knows that it's coming into your territory. And Zoe texted back straight away. She said, okay, boss. She was a good girl. She knew what it was about. She'd show up, he'd tell her off, and then he'd make them both a cup of tea and send her on her way. Easy. But he felt a lurch of worry for Zoe. He had tried so hard to get it right with her. He'd been a terrible dad himself, but Zoe and Kate sometimes felt like his second chance. He cared, more than he probably should on his salary, for these two women he'd trained since they were 19. He let himself daydream about what he'd do to the guy who'd smeared Zoe all over the internet. Oh, they were pretty good, these vengeance fantasies. With functioning knees, you could kick all kinds of shit out of a fellow. This was one of the many advantages that thinking held over reality. Still, he did care about Zoe. She was hard to read, and maybe that's why he liked her so much. For all he knew, she really believed in the good-looking losers that she fell for. He often tried to talk about it with her, but she always made a joke of it, as if arriving for her early morning training session with her heart in tiny pieces was the most everyday evil to be endured, like losing an earring or not finding a seat on the bus. She was defensive, and sometimes that came out as sarcasm, and she was right. What would he know about a young woman searching for love? But if Tom had to pin it down, he'd say she was more vulnerable than reckless. The trouble was, he saw stuff in men that Zoe could never see. He knew what men were like. He couldn't blame Zoe for being desperate. The odds against her finding love rose every day. She was only getting more notorious, and men were only getting worse. The planet was filling up with good-looking young worldlings built entirely of opposites, cancelling themselves out and, speaking as a bloke, leaving nothing that you'd honestly want to go for a drink with. This new species of guys, they paired city shoes with backwards beards. They played in bands, but they worked in offices. They hated the rich, but they bought lottery tickets. They laughed at comedies about the shittiness of lives that were based quite pointedly on their own. And worst of all, they were so endlessly gossipy. Every single thing they did, from unboxing a phone through to sleeping with his athlete, they had this compulsion to stick it online and see what everyone else thought. Their lives were a howling vacuum that sucked in attention. He didn't see how Zoe could ever find love with this new breed of men with cyclonic souls that sucked like Dysons and never needed their bag changed in order to keep on and on sucking. Tom swore at himself and put the thought away. The agent was right. He was an old man. Also, he was probably thinking about Zoe too much. He checked his watch. 40 minutes to go till she arrived. His watch was a Casio. It was splash-proof. And it did exactly one thing, which was to tell the time. This was another difference between him and guys these days. They all wore James Bond watches with separate chronometer dials, resistant to a depth of 1,000 metres. What did they think was going to happen to them? That they would be thrown clear from the high street stores where they worked and sink to the bottom of the Mariana Trench, from which they would swim clear only owing to their ability to time events to the split second? Those guys wouldn't know a fraction of a second if it jumped up and denied them an Olympic medal. They had no concept of what could be won and lost in one. Time was wasted on this new breed of man who could spend a whole night with a woman and then upload it in less than a minute. Thank you. Thank you very much. I think hopefully meeting Tom has given you an idea of the chaos that Zoe leaves behind her on every page of the book. She's an absolute head case, I think we would say in the UK. She leaves a trail of human destruction behind her. And yet she's one of the characters that I've liked most. She's committed absolutely everything to the thing that she does. She's decided that she wants to win in her sport, which is track cycling, at all costs. And that means surrendering everything that doesn't make her quicker and cutting out everything from her life that means that she might miss a training session or miss competition. She has no one in her life to slow her down. But also she doesn't have anyone in her life who cares. She has no one who minds whether she ultimately succeeds and does this thing that she's searching for, which is to win an Olympic gold medal. She has a great rival and a great antagonist who's called Kate. And Kate is running a completely different program in her life. She has a husband she loves. She has a child she adores. And that means that sometimes she will miss a training session. Sometimes she'll miss competition. But she has these people who care whether she achieves the thing she's going for. And in the long term, that starts to work out for her. And when we join the two women at the beginning of the novel, Zoe is starting to get the idea that maybe, even though Kate has won a lot less in her life, maybe she has achieved a more elusive and a more valuable kind of gold. Zoe gets a kind of vertigo and thinks, I would like that life. And that's where the story really launches. I really wanted to write about rivals. I really wanted to write about ambitious people. The heart of this story is really, you know, what comes first in your life? The ambition that you have or the people that you love? It's a really pointed question. And when I ask questions like that, I try to find the most appropriate people to ask that question of. And I looked at Olympians. I looked at athletes. And the reason is that they're the most ambitious people I could think of. I don't know if it's the case for most of you in the room, but it's certainly the case for me, is that not everybody else in the world needs to fail in order for me to succeed. I hope that's true for all of you. You seem like very nice people. It's not true of Olympians. Actually, to step up onto the top step, you need to destroy the dreams of everybody else in order to achieve your own. It's a rare and unique thing that we're asking these people to do. It actually involves competing, sometimes at a very bitter level, against the people you know best. America is a great example of a country which excels in so many sports. I mean, you will probably go right to the top of the medal table in the Olympics that are going to start in a week's time. That's a terrific thing. And that means there's many sports, many of the track and field disciplines, for example, where it's pretty certain that the gold medal is going to go to an American athlete. And that means that the real battle for the Olympic gold medal happens in the American athletic trials for selection for the Olympic Games. And the special circumstance of that is that you're pitting athletes against each other who've grown up in the sport. Right? They've gone away at age 12 to sporting academies. They know each other better than anyone else in the world. Often they are the best of friends. And suddenly they become the bitterest of rivals. And that was an absolutely fascinating sport to explore for that reason. So I've taken these two athletes, they're British athletes in this case, but the same applies, and really examined them. And I wanted to know what that felt like, you know, to race, to win, to lose. And my writing is very research-based. I like to go out and learn a lot about these hidden worlds that I write about and try to make them real for people. And this was the most problematic world I've ever researched as a writer, because I was interviewing lots of athletes and I was saying to them, well, I need to know what it feels like, you know, to win and to lose. What does it feel like in here when you win a race that you really care about? And they would say things like, oh, well, it's indescribable. So I was like, help me out. And they were like, no, you really can't describe it. I was like, it's my job. They said, you're going to have to do it. You know, you'll have to, if you really want to know what it feels like to win or to lose a race that you've really invested a lot in, then invest a lot in it and go and race, you know, and then come back and we'll have a conversation about what it feels like to win and lose. They're quite hardcore, these athletes, quite uncompromising. I like that about them. And so, like an idiot, I decided that I would do it. And I should give you some background here about my status as a sports person at that point. I had a PE teacher at school. You say PE teacher, right? Yeah. And he wrote the following on my school report at the end of one term. Christopher tries very hard. but we find that it is safer to pass him a book than the ball. That's the background I was coming from. But I decided to train up. You know, I was not grotesquely unfit, but I wasn't very fit either. And I got myself a bike and I started going out on it 15, 20, 25 hours a week and pushing myself very hard, training very intensely. After about the first month of that, I felt pain, sadness, and not many other emotions, you know. After about 6 weeks, I had my first positive event. I had a breakthrough. I looked down at my legs in the shower, and they were someone else's legs. I thought, this is wonderful. I had muscles and everything. They looked like little tree trunks. And I went out, and I took them out on the road again for another month. I was like, come on, legs, do your stuff. And I would kill myself going up these hills. And I trained unbelievably hard at really, really high intensity levels. And after about 3 months of this, I learned the first important thing that I learned about athletes, which is that they feel terrible most of the time. This was a huge revelation to me. Right? We see them as lay people. We see them stepping up to the start line when they seem to glow with inner light. They look fabulous. It must feel like their blood is full of fizzy electricity. You know, they're radiant. And I learned that that's because they've been resting for 10 days before they step up to the big event. Most of the time, they feel like I did after 3 months of training, which was at death's door. Exhausted, emotional. The slightest piece of stress will actually put you in quite a tearful state. Right? The phone goes and you scowl at it. Right? You're on edge all the time because you're so exhausted. This is what they feel like. They're operating on the absolute limit of health, just at the point where it's about to tip over into illness all the time. And, you know, the reason they do that is to get stronger. This is how the body reacts. You know, if you really push your body super hard, it feels terrible. And it says to itself, how can we, the cells of this person's body, make sure that this never happens to us again? Right? And so things happen, like, you know, you get muscles, or your heart and lungs adapt, you get more capillaries. There's adaptation. You need to put a hard training stress on to get that adaptation. I didn't know that. I didn't know how awful athletes feel all the time. After about 4 months of it, I was still feeling awful, but there was progress, right? I could cycle up hills quite fast that I used to have to walk up. I was starting to beat my training partners to the tops of hills, and I was starting to get a savage kind of joy from that, which I hadn't expected. I didn't know that was hiding inside. I was starting to call these people my training partners. I used to call them my friends. It was an obvious sign that something had gone really badly wrong in my head. I was screaming motivational slogans at myself while I cycled up hills. Yeah, I'm an early middle-aged man in Lycra. Terrifying prospect, that was. So I wanted to race, and I wanted to know what it felt like to win and to lose. I really needed to know. I was desperate by this point, because I had done a ton of other research, which I'll tell you about in a minute, but I was desperate to write my novel. I'd become obsessed by it. I decided it was the thing I really needed to write, but I wanted to win something, to see how that felt, because I wanted to write these race scenes where my hero, you know, Zoe had become my hero. I wanted her to win, and I wanted to describe with some veracity what it felt like to do that. So I went and raced a friend of mine. And this is a friend who has the merit of being a world champion cyclist. What could possibly go wrong, right? And she, in the masters category, 5 years ago, she won the world championships on the track in the sprint. I mean, she's amazing. She's the real deal, and she has the stripy rainbow jersey to prove it, hung up on the wall of her kitchen. And so we went for a ride. I gate crashed her training ride and went to the place where she was staying, and we got kitted up and we went for a ride. And this was a long sort of 15-mile hill that goes out from the back of where she was staying. And the deal was that we would do a warm-up. We would go up this hill, take it easy at first, and then maybe a bit more seriously. You know, my agenda was this was definitely a race. And then we would see what happened. So we started off, and straight out of the gate, she set an absolutely murderous pace. This was the warm-up. And after about 5 minutes, I was in real trouble. And I've got 6 months of really, really hard training behind me, and I'm feeling pretty special by this point that I should be beating her. But I wasn't. Here's another thing that I learned from interviewing athletes and coaches. Never, ever, ever show weakness. I was talking to this great Australian coach. He was like, never show weakness. Why would you? That was his advice. That was pretty much it. No, don't ever let anyone see that you're suffering or feeling unsure of yourself. So what I did, despite really being in trouble, was that I accelerated. I went in front of her so that she couldn't see my face. Right? Couldn't see me gasping for air and perspiring and looking awful. And so I put myself in front, and from behind, you know, I had relaxed shoulders. I was projecting that everything was okay. You know, even while my face was contorted in some agony. And it worked. You know, after about 15 minutes of this, I was still ahead, and we were going up this hill, and it was pretty steep, and I was absolutely on my limit, but she was still behind me, and she'd gone really quiet, which is a good sign, because my friend is usually really chatty. And I was wearing a heart rate monitor. I always do when I cycle, and I knew that I was at my absolute limit. I was at my maximum heart rate that I could sustain, you know, one more beat per minute, and I would really kind of blow up, and there'd be all kinds of problems. I was feeling sick, really nauseous, you know, when you're absolutely on your limit. And she was still behind me. It was all fine, you know, and we got, you know, about half an hour of this, we were getting to the top of the hill. And she was still behind me, and she was still quiet. And I was thinking, this is fantastic, because I've sort of beaten the world champion here. And so I am a kind of world champion. And I did know in that moment what it felt like to win something that you'd trained for really hard and had invested a lot of hope in. It felt indescribable. And we were just getting to the top of the hill, and it was amazing. You know, I was in so much trouble. I'd lost, you know, half my body weight, I should think, in sweat, and I was getting tunnel vision, you know, which is your body's way of telling you that you've seen enough. At this point, Siobhan, my friend, comes up to the side of me and looks across at me. She's fine, by the way. She's absolutely fine. She looks a bit glowy, like she's just done some exercise and that's it. And she looks across at me with an expression of concern. Are you okay? I sort of pretend that I'm okay. In her hand is her mobile phone. Turns out the reason she's been so quiet as we've gone up the hill is because she's been finalising her online grocery delivery. So we have this company called Tesco Direct. I'm sure you have an equivalent. And they have an app that you can put on your phone and you can organise your family's grocery shop through it. Well, that's what she'd been doing, and it was quite involved in technical work, and that's why she'd been so quiet. She puts her cell phone back in her pocket, looks across at me, and she says, "That was a good warm-up. Shall we go then?" and so that was it, you know. I had to say, well, she should go. And she went. You know, she went and did a four-hour intense training block in the mountains. And I went also back down the hill. I freewheeled back down into what I've called ordinary life ever since. I went to the beach and had an ice cream, and it was... It was great. And it was actually a really efficient piece of research, I realised, halfway down the hill, because I had learned within the space of 50 seconds what it felt like to win and to lose. Something that you'd invested a lot in, you know? And I did. I went home and I started to write my book. And I only, in that moment, I only acquired more respect for these people who are champions. Right. This is the next important thing that I learned about athletes. There is absolutely no way that someone like me could become someone like them. This is a huge thing I learned about elite level athletes, and especially Olympians, is the enormous genetic gulf that exists between them and the rest of the population. They are like superheroes. And yet, at that elite level, you know, they still have to train unbelievably hard because everyone else who's playing at that level is bionic too. Right? But I developed a fascination for athletes that anyone has for someone that they could never be. You know, this sort of nostalgia, a kind of yearning for these people that we can't be, you know, that climb hills like they're lighter than air, that are incredibly powerful, that are also incredibly smart. I mean, one of the things I learned about athletes was just how smart they are. And this was in stark contrast to everything that I'd been brought up to believe about athletes, because we watch the interviews with them just after they've won a big event that they've invested a lot in, and it is indescribable, and someone puts a microphone in their face while they're still out of breath and says, "How do you feel?" And naturally they say, "Oh, it was great, it was great, it was great, it was absolutely great. I'm just so pleased I won, really pleased I didn't let anyone down, really pleased I didn't let the team down. It was great to see all those flags waving out there on the course. Thanks, guys, I'm really pleased, thanks." And you could be forgiven for thinking, if you just watched the interviews with athletes like that, that they're not very bright. And just the opposite is the case, you know, where they interview them at the wrong time. You know, I started interviewing them in the middle of rainy training sessions, you know, 3 years away from an Olympics, way before competition, before they even had a realistic chance of being selected for the Olympics, and discovered a psychological depth to them that was fascinating. Discovered how smart they are, how tactically aware, how in charge of their own emotions. And this is a very important thing. When it hurts in training, dumb people stop. It hurts, well, I'll stop then. Smart people think, okay, how much does this hurt? You know, what does it mean to me to endure this hurt? How do I intellectualize that? How do I have a relationship with suffering that's less emotional? No, very smart people. And so I learned a lot about them, hopefully enough to write the book. And when I was researching them, I discovered this other thing that I loved about sport, which is that it's the opposite of everything that feels mortal to us. You know, it's the opposite of death and disease and entropy and decay. That's why we love it, I think. That's why we love the Olympics. You know, the motto of the Olympics is swifter, higher, stronger. It's the opposite of everything that's happening to me. I thought it was beautiful. And so I thought if I wanted to tell a true story about athletes and about their rivalries, I needed to weave it in with its opposite. And so if you read Gold, you'll see that my athlete who has a family has one of the things that's a consequence of having a family, which is that stuff happens in a family. And Kate's child, called Sophie, starts to get sick. And during the course of the story, we start to realise how sick she's getting. And then she's diagnosed with something that's increasingly prevalent in our societies, and it's childhood leukemia. And Kate is going to have to make a very real choice suddenly between this arbitrary rivalry, this struggle that she's making for gold, and a real life and death struggle that suddenly presents itself in her life. And I had to go and do a different kind of research, completely different. I went to research illness. I went to a hospital in London called Great Ormond Street Hospital. It's a children's hospital, and it specialises in children with leukemia and lymphoma. And I shadowed a doctor there, a paediatric haematologist, who works with very sick children. And I was in his consulting room while he was offering the diagnoses of these very serious illnesses to the parents and to the children. And you can imagine that that's a very emotionally febrile environment. It's extraordinary, and you're expecting it, you're ready for it. So are the parents, by the way. You know, these diagnoses don't fall out of a blue sky. They have typically gone to their local doctor, and the local doctor hasn't really liked the look of it and has referred them to their local specialist hospital, like their local children's hospital, and they haven't liked the look of it either, and they've been referred probably to their local specialist oncology unit, and from there referred to really the top-level hospital in the London area, which is Great Ormond Street Hospital for Children. And so they know that this is not going to be an anodyne diagnosis. They know it's going to be really serious. But still, nothing prepares them for that diagnosis being pronounced, you know, in the air of that room. And to see the effect on them is extraordinary. Absolutely extraordinary. And then to follow up the treatment of these children through various stages of chemotherapy and recovery, because more than 90% of these children now recover, was an amazing and an inspiring thing. And I saw a lot of things in the hospital that I hadn't expected at all. You see some awful stuff as well. First thing I saw when I walked into Great Ormond Street Hospital, walking along a corridor, was a child, and he was about, I'm guessing, 7 years old. He had no hair, because it had all gone from the chemotherapy. He was wearing a green hospital gown. You know those little gowns that lace up at the sides? He was very thin, and he was pushing a drip stand, an intravenous drip stand. Do you know what I mean by that? Like with tubes coming out of the bag, down into his arms, needles taking the fluid directly into his arms, and the needles taped down, and he was pushing this stand on wheels along the corridor towards me. And as he was coming towards me, he was making a noise which sounded like this. And it was the worst thing. Your heart breaks. You look at that and you just think, yep, that's the saddest thing I've ever seen. This very sick child moaning as he comes down the corridor. He came closer. He was still making this noise. Pushing his intravenous drip stand. And I realised that I was sort of transfixed, and I was in his way, and he looked up at me, and I was like, oh, sorry, and I moved out of the way slightly. And as he came past me, still making this noise, he looked up at me, and this little smile came across his face, and he made this noise. He changed gear. He was driving his intravenous drip stand up the central corridor of Great Ormond Street Hospital for Sick Children. And he was having a blast. He was having a fantastic time because, as well as being a very sick 7-year-old boy, he was also a 7-year-old boy. And no one had told him he was supposed to be miserable. I've met loads of people in the hospital. I saw some stuff that was really harrowing and some stuff that I thought was beautiful and turned into the character of Sophie in this novel, who's a child who has leukemia and is absolutely certain that she's going to survive. And in the meantime, nobody has told her that she's meant to be depressed about it. You know, she just didn't get the memo. But you see some terrible, you see some weird things in a place like that. I saw a girl who was 12 or 13 years old, and she was wearing a plastic surgical-looking suit, and it was flesh-toned. Have you seen prosthetic limbs that are almost but not quite matched to the skin colour of the recipient? Well, it was like that, sort of almost skin-coloured. And it was inflated, right, this plastic suit, so that her arms were away from the sides of her torso, you know, by about 30 or 40 degrees. And I'd assumed, because they have a dermatology unit at Great Ormond Street Hospital, I'd assumed that there was something wrong with her skin, you know, and that her skin had some malady that meant it couldn't touch itself, or that maybe she'd had burns. You know, sometimes the skin is not allowed to touch itself in that situation. So she was wearing this inflated suit. And I was very curious to know what was wrong with her, but you can't go and ask someone what's wrong with you. It's rude. And so I asked one of the nurses there. I said, what's wrong with her? And the nurse had a good look at her and thought about it for a second. And then she said, oh, no, there's nothing wrong with her. That's a sumo wrestler's suit. And she's just here to entertain the children on the ward. She was a volunteer, you know? You go into these places and you walk in there with a head state that's expecting to see misery, and when you don't, it's a real shock and a revelation and a beautiful thing. You know, a hospital, I discovered, is one of the most life-affirming places there is, especially a children's hospital, especially where children are basically, for the most part, recovering and going on to live what, you know, what we hope will be a long and healthy life. You know, and in the meantime, there's no point being angst-ridden about it, and these places aren't. They're incredibly results driven, and they're always hopeful and looking to the future. And I found it one of the most inspiring places I'd ever been. You know, we live in a time where we're getting sort of very jaded and mistrustful of a lot of institutions, and this was one that I just thought was hitting it out of the park. You know, they were amazing people. And so what I did in Gold, I hope, it's the first novel I've written which is a celebration of some groups of people that I ended up having a lot of time for and thinking were fantastic. You know, it's increasingly important for me and my work to be looking for things to celebrate. A lot of my early work and my early novels were talking a lot about the things that are imperfect with our world, things that are very difficult and sad. And whilst that's still true, that what I'm attracted to now in my fiction is examples of people who have found a way to live with a kind of grace, and elegance even, despite the obvious fact that we live in a world that has a lot of trouble, a lot of problems. And so if you read Gold, I hope you will read it as a celebration of the human struggle, you know, the struggle between Kate and Zoe, who are trying to win Gold, and their reactions when that struggle is suddenly thrown into stark relief by the greater battle that Sophie, who's the other main character of the novel, starts to fight, which is literally a life and death struggle. And I hope it's an examination of some of our deepest values of rivalry, of friendship, of sickness, and of health. If you read it, I hope you'll enjoy it. I'm conscious that it's only come out very recently. You won't all have read it. I hope that some of you do. But I can't spoil it for you by telling you anything more about what happens in the story, other than to say that it's, I think, the most emotionally engaged novel that I've written. And if you read it, I really hope that you'll enjoy it. It's designed to be enjoyed. And if you have any questions about Gold or about any of my previous novels or newspaper work or Her Majesty the Queen of England, I'm delighted to answer. And it's the bit that I like most, so please fire away. Hi.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, so the question is, why are so many of my characters female? Yeah. Okay. And what's the second part of your question, please? So the second part of your question is, who designs the covers, and do I let them know ahead of time what I'm working on? Well, may I answer that second question first? The person who designed my original American cover is a guy called Roberto DeVicq, which is D-E and then V-I-C-Q. He has a website which I'd invite everyone to have a look at, which is called DeVicq.com. And he's a typographer and a calligrapher, hugely impressive artist. And his stuff is really beautiful to look at. And he designed the cover of Little Bee, which I think is iconic. And I feel that I owe a lot to him. You know this adage that one shouldn't judge a book by its cover? Well, whilst being true up to a point, a cover suddenly makes you pick up the book and be curious about reading the first page. You know, and that's what I hope people will do. If they read the first page of one of my stories, I hope it will make them really curious about what's on the second page. But that doesn't happen until they open the book. And so as a writer, in common with a lot of writers, I feel a huge debt to the people who design the jackets. And, you know, it's not unimportant. And I don't think they get enough credit. I think their names should be right up there on the jacket. If it was a movie, if a book was a movie, you'd be used to a whole scrolling list of credits. They'd probably come in as a subtitle on pages 3, 5, 7, and 9, you know, featuring on the cover, Roberto DeVicq. And they'd have the name of the editor and they'd have the names of some booksellers, you know, everyone who's made the thing possible. But Roberto DeVicq, they don't know in advance what we're working on. They respond to the manuscript when it's in, and they read it, and then they have to decide, you know, do we make this a representational cover? Do we try to depict what's going on in the book, or do we just try to make a beautiful cover that people will want to look at? Or how do we do it? And some of the negotiations that you have about covers are the most interesting conversations in fiction. Because people are asking you, so what's your book about? And actually, you know, if you can't tell them in a way that can be expressed in art, then they can't design the cover. So for Gold, I tell them, well, it's the story about two women who are rivals. And that's what that looks like in a cover, you know? Covers. I'm fascinated by them. I wish that you could see the first 7 versions of the cover. You know, we go through a lot. The second part of your question, your first question was, why do I write so many female characters and why do I write from a woman's point of view sometimes? I started writing from a female point of view because I didn't want to write about myself. The kind of fiction that I do, it's a hybrid between journalism, reportage, and fiction. So my job is to go out and find a hidden world, one that we don't know much about, to find out true things about it and to report back in a way that's emotionally true. And this is something I can do in fiction. You know, I can make something that's true here. And there's a real test of truth when you read a book. Does it feel right in here? You know, you can spot a phony book from a mile off. So that's my job, to try and do the research, to tell the story in a way that feels true. So I made a rule for myself that I don't want to be writing about myself. I want to be going out, finding a story and reporting back on it. And so I started writing from a female point of view to make sure that I wasn't writing about my own life. I made a rule for myself that I would cross at least one boundary every time I picked up the pen. Right? So I would cross a boundary of gender or of nationality or of politics or of ethnicity. Anything to make sure I wasn't me. Anything so that I could get up every morning and do this thing which is really exciting as a writer, to say, well, who shall I be today? You know, this is one of the few freedoms that we have, really. You know, we have a life that's very constrained by the need to make money and finalise our online grocery delivery and work out whether we want coffee with, you know, soy milk or real milk or whatever, you know, it's a very busy life. And actually one of the few freedoms we have is an emotional freedom. To say, well, I can walk into this room and in my head, secretly, without anyone knowing, I can be whoever I want. And so I played these games with myself. I thought of having different sliders to set that I could set in life. Because someone explained to me once that being a white, heterosexual, middle-class male is life played on the very easiest possible difficulty setting. And I thought, yeah, that's absolutely right. So in my head, I changed the sliders around. I say, okay, well, I'm going to change my ethnicity and my sexuality and my gender and my political alignment and my age and whatever. I reset these sliders in my head and I walk into a room and I think, right, okay, so now with that new set of parameters, who do I think in this room is interesting? Who would I want to go and talk to? Who do I feel threatened by? You know, who am I excited to know more about? Who do I feel jealous of, or whatever? What's the first question that I would ask this person in that new head state? So I started writing from a female point of view because it's an amazing game to play with yourself. It's amazing. Just to say, okay, I'm going to really try and experience what it feels like to be a different gender. And it became really addictive. It gives you a different set of eyes to see the world with. The reason I started writing Gold from a female point of view is because I discovered, by thinking from a female point of view, what a bigger story than... I mean, if I'd written two male athletes, I'd have missed out on so much. I discovered that female athletes are doing so much more than their male peers, for example. At exactly the point where they reach the apex of their physical performance, you know, in their mid-20s to mid-30s, that's exactly the point in women's lives where they're being asked, hey, guess what, do you want to settle down and have a child? And if a male athlete decides, yeah, I'm going to become a parent, now he'll miss maybe a week of training, won't miss a single competition. If a female athlete decides that she wants to have a child, now she's going to miss maybe 3 seasons of competition, you know, 3 years of training, 3 years of results that her rival is going to get and she isn't. You know? So female athletes are doing so much more. You know, they're giving up a lot. They're so committed. They're more hardcore. And I became really interested in that psychology. I became also interested in other things. Once you start going down that route, athletes get paid with product endorsements, really. That's how they make their money. And they're very focused on that. Well, I discovered there's a double standard in terms of how male and female athletes get those product endorsements. You know? For a male athlete, it's necessary only to have fantastic results in your sport. In my country, in the UK, there are a number of soccer players who are absolutely terrific at scoring goals, and really not that much to look at, you know? They're just sort of average looking, but they're the face of everything. They're on billboards everywhere. Whereas for a female athlete, it's necessary not only to excel in your sport, but also to look terrific if you want to be the face of something. It's a hypocrisy. It's a double standard. Or I looked at women's sport itself, and it's incredibly underrepresented on television. You wouldn't know that it existed sometimes. You see all of these men, like, fighting it out. You know, we've just seen the Tour de France. It was amazing. It was 220 men on bikes. There's actually a female equivalent of the Tour de France. Doesn't make it on TV at all. Why not? It's no less interesting. You know, the athletes are no less committed, no more, you know, no less engaged. I started to get really angry about it, as a woman. You know? Only one more question. All right, I'm so sorry. I should have... Hi.
Hi. Here in Colorado, we have a lot of evidence cycling. We have some pretty good hills.
Yep.
And there's a lot of animosity between vehicle drivers and the cyclists. The fact we have laws to that. It's very polarized. I'm wondering if you have the same issue on your side of the pond, if you have any negative experiences while you're cycling.
What a great question. Yeah, the question's about the relationship between cyclists, of which there are very many avid cyclists in Colorado, and motor car drivers. Yeah. Hey, you've got some amazing cyclists in Colorado. TJ Van Garderen, doesn't he train in Boulder?
Yeah.
Yeah. So he just won the white jersey for the best young rider in the Tour de France. He's probably going to win it one day. And the guy's a legend. You know, he's part of this new generation of youngsters who are doing it clean. You know, he trains, I think, with Taylor Finney. Does he train out of Boulder as well? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Again, such a lovely guy, a legend. I follow him on Twitter. just I really, really like his attitude. Yeah, there's a lot of great cyclists out of Colorado. And I know I've read about a lot about the accidents that are happening, the number of people that are just getting wiped out. I know a guy who was run over by all nine wheels of one side of an 18-wheeler truck in Colorado while he was doing a ride across America. And it's not just Colorado, it's every state, and it's not just America, it's my country too. There is something happening, isn't there? The car culture is giving way to a more physical culture. There's a lot of people who hate that. I think it has a lot to do with new participation in cycling, a lot more people out on the roads. It has to do with the times we live in, where a lot of people who, you know, they have the kind of life change that I had, where previously they might have gone out and bought a little red sports car. They go and buy a bike instead and go out. And there's a lot of people that aren't happy with that, you know, feel a kind of resentment towards that. I sometimes think that cyclists don't help themselves. You know, I ride a lot in my country, and I see every day examples of cyclists amping up that confrontation, you know, swearing, gesticulating, screaming at car drivers, whereas obviously the right thing to do is just to, you know, eyes forward, ignore it. It's happening more and more. I don't think legislation's the answer. I think humanizing people is the answer. So my response in fiction, whenever I see something that I think is unfair or unjust, rather than trying to come up with a powerful response, I try to come up with a fragile response, you know, and make these people human. So in my last novel, for example, Little Bee, when I was exercised about the politics of immigration, I didn't write a political book. I wrote a book that made one immigrant human. And I think if cyclists want to do something to help themselves, that we could do a campaign to say, look, whose son, whose sister, you know, whose mother was it that just got killed on the road? You know, and I think by showing them that we're not just automata in Lycra, we're not robots, we're actually people who have to go home to children who are waiting for us. You know, I think slowly that message would come across. I don't know if that's a helpful response, but it's a sincere one. Thanks. Have we really not got time for any more questions? I'm so sorry. I must have talked for too long. Sorry. Thanks.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.